Let us move on to the next stage of dependent origination, and just to recap briefly what we have done so far. We have looked at the first three or four factors of this sequence, and we saw how when you start off with being deluded and having a wrong view about reality, about the world, what the world is like, what you are like, what the mind is like, then as a consequence, see if I can get this microphone a bit more. Okay, then as a consequence of that, you do all kind of things. You do all these activities, searching for happiness in the world. But because you have wrong ideas about where happiness is to be found and where suffering is to be avoided, it means you're looking for those things in the wrong place. And that all this looking, all this activity we do to find happiness in the world, to avoid suffering, these are the sankharas. This is the will, the second factor of dependent arising here. So based on delusion, we do all these activities, right? One thing leading to the next one here. And when we, all these activities that we do, they have an impact on our mind. We do kind activities, it has a positive impact on our mind. We do bad things, it has a bad impact on our mind. So it's like our consciousness, our mind, the level it has, or the happiness it has, or the quality that it has, will depend on all the actions that we do. So we're coming from a misunderstanding of reality. That misunderstanding leads to all these activities. And those activities in turn determine the quality of our mind, the quality of our consciousness. And this is vijnana, the third factor of dependent arising here. And of course, one of the purposes of living a good life and living a spiritual life is to actually affect the quality of our consciousness, to make the mind more bright, more happy, more joyous, to take away those fetters and anchors that are holding it down and making it dark, to get rid of all that. This is part of the purpose of this entire spiritual life. And as we do that, consciousness gets lifted up. If you don't live this kind of life and you live a bad life, you're dragging yourself down. And that level that you have when eventually you die, when eventually you pass away, that level that you have established yourself at through your practice or whatever, that is where you continue into the future existence as well. So the consciousness, the mind we have in this life is roughly where we will continue also into the future life, because that is where what we enjoy, what we like, right? We are kind of projecting ourselves into that. That is what consciousness is holding on to, so to speak. Yeah. And once you then get reborn into that kind of existence, then the things that you will experience in that new kind of existence will depend on the level of where you're at. So if you get reborn as an animal, you have certain kind of experiences, right? A lot of things which aren't very nice, and you know, you get, if you're a kangaroo, you get to eat grass all the time, very boring. And that's the least of the suffering, right? The eating of the grass. You can see when you eat, when you give the kangaroo some nice food, wow, the kind of the eyes light up, right? Get a piece of chocolate cake or something, it's like, whoa, what's going on? Never had this before. It's very sweet when you see that. But it's basically not a very nice life, and so your experiences are then confined according to where your consciousness gets established. If it gets established in a very high realm that relates to an experiences of meditation, for example, then of course the range of experiences you can have is very narrow, and they tend to be very happy experiences. In the human realm, it's the same kind of thing. We tend to have certain experiences that are typical for the human realm, certain types of pleasure, certain types of suffering, etc. And this is what this next stage is about, when we talk about consciousness being the condition for nama rupa. This is what it says here. This is again from an extract from the Sutta on Dependent Origination. Consciousness is the condition for name and form. And then you have the opposite. So when we have the cessation, then with the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. And what, bhikkhus, is name and form? It is feeling, perception, the will, contact, attention. This is called name. and the four great elements and the form derived from the four great elements. This is called form. This is rupa. Thus, this name and this form are together called name and form. So what this means is that name here, as I was saying yesterday, name is basically all the aspects of mind apart from consciousness. Consciousness is a condition for this, but all the other aspects of mind are really what is here classed as name. It might be better to call it mentality, right? Mentality, all the mental aspects might be more easy to understand what is going on. And often it is translated as mentality, this word nama. So all the aspects, and those aspects are usually, if you look at the five khandhas, right, the five groups of existence, you have form, feeling, perception, volition, and consciousness. Those are the five. So nama is those three which are not form and not consciousness. So feelings, perceptions, and the will. That's basically what nama is in this context. It's defined slightly differently here. You have contact and attention added, but it doesn't really make any difference. It is still, that is what it really is referring to. So all of those mental aspects. And form, the material aspect of existence, at the time of the Buddha, they didn't have the periodic table or anything like that. So it was a bit more simple, but the way they looked at form in those days, and I think it's quite a nice way of looking at it actually, is as the four great elements. And the four great elements, and this was also apparently a classification used in the ancient Greek world as well. So this is kind of a universal way of looking at matter. So you have the solidity aspect, right? The solid aspect, you have the water, you have the air, and then you have the temperature, the fire aspect, or the heat aspect of matter. And I think that's quite a nice summary of what material phenomena are like. And then it says those things that are derived from the four great elements, and that is any other aspect that may come under material phenomena, such as the eye, for example, the ability to see, the vision, that ability to see is partly based on material phenomena as well, etc., etc. I don't have to go into detail about that. You get the general idea about what is going on here. So what this is saying is that consciousness is the condition for this name and form, this mentality, the mental aspect and the material aspect. And this is a condition in two ways. First of all, there has to be consciousness there for there to be name and form, right? If there's no consciousness, you can't have any other aspects of the mind. You can't have feelings and perceptions without consciousness. You have to be aware of what's going on. So consciousness is like the basic aspect of existence that makes everything else possible. You cannot experience form, right? The reason why we experience form, solidity, heat, and all these kind of things is because, again, of consciousness. Consciousness is what allows you to experience form, material phenomena. It is all experienced in consciousness. Consciousness is like the final thing which makes everything else possible. So this is the first way. You have to have consciousness to be able to experience these other things. But as I said, it also has to do with what type of form you experience, what type of feeling you experience, what type of perception you experience. So as I said just a second ago, if you get reborn in a nice realm that corresponds to a deep meditation experience, you have very beautiful feelings, very beautiful perceptions. Very bliss, you feel a lot of bliss and happiness. The form you experience is very refined, right? So it's not just the fact that consciousness gives rise to mentality and materiality. That's one thing. It also gives rise to the type of materiality and mentality that you experience. So these are the two ways, and these things condition each other. And then when consciousness comes to an end, then of course all of this name, all the mentality and the materiality also must come to an end, because you can't experience these things anymore. It's important to understand that when Buddhism talks about materiality and mentality, we're talking about the experience of these things, right? Whether there is any materiality out there in the world apart from experience, it's really irrelevant from a Buddhist perspective. It is experience that matters. because it is our experienced reality that we have to deal with. That's where suffering and happiness is. That's actually where the problems arise. What the world is out there is kind of irrelevant. So when we talk about material phenomena, we're talking about our personal experience and not what might exist out there, right? If anything does, galaxies and whatever it is. So that is what is meant by this. This is why they condition each other in this way. And this is very interesting, and this is one of the kind of crucial aspects of the Buddhist way of understanding this, what the world is, the way that consciousness and name and form condition each other. And it's actually a mutual conditionality here. It is not just that consciousness conditions nama rupa, name and form, but consciousness in turn is also conditioned by nama rupa, name and form. So it's a mutual conditioning. They uphold each other. The simile in the suttas is like two sheaths of reed leaning against each other. You take away one, the other one falls down. Take away the other one falls down. They are mutually supportive. And we'll see this in a second, how this works. And this mutual conditionality also is the thing that shows us how samsara, this round of becoming, is sustained without a self, without any kind of permanent entity in there. And it shows us the middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. How they can be this middle way, and how it is that dependent origination shows us this middle way. So we are really here coming to the very core aspects of the Buddhist teachings. Some of the most profound parts of what Buddhism is all about actually are found in this particular conditional relationship between name and form and consciousness. So this is very, very profound stuff. And if you don't grasp everything that I'm going to talk about, that's fine. It doesn't matter so much, because at least I'm sure you will understand a lot of it. And these things often take a while to really sink in. So if you're not used to some of these ideas, don't be too concerned about that. And we're here really dealing more with the philosophical side of Buddhism, but it shows you how Buddhism actually works, why it is possible, really, to make an end of suffering. This shows you why it is possible at the end of the day. So I will explain this in more detail as we go along, how this works. But first of all, let's have a look at this discourse called the Great Discourse on Origination, the Mahanidana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 15, and it shows us the relationship between consciousness and name and form, or materiality and mentality, if you like. So this is how this sutta goes. It's quite a well-known sutta, and it's the main sutta in the whole Pali Canon on dependent origination, probably. Goes into most detail. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the exalted one, or the blessed one, was living among the Kurus, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasa Dhamma. Then the venerable Ananda approached the exalted one, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. Seated, he said this to the exalted one, "It is wonderful and marvelous, venerable sir, how this dependent arising is so deep and appears so deep, yet to myself it seems as clear can be." "Do not say so, Ananda, do not say so, Ananda. This dependent arising, Ananda, is deep, and it appears deep, because of not understanding and not penetrating this Dhamma. Ananda, this generation has become like a tangled skein, like a knotted ball of thread, like matted rushes and reeds, and does not pass beyond samsara with its plane of misery, unfortunate destination, and lower realms." Right, so here is Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant for 20 years, and he goes to the Buddha and says, "Wow, I really understand this dependent arising. It's really deep, but I've got it." That's what he's saying, right? And the Buddha says, "Be careful, because this is very profound, and it's not easy to understand this fully." And I don't make any claim to be able to teach all the aspects of dependent arising myself. I just do the things that seem obvious, and I'm sure there are many aspects of this teaching that I'm missing out simply because it is very profound. But anyway, you get some idea of what's going on. That's the most important thing here. And it is precisely by not understanding this. And when we talk about understanding dependent arising, we talk, of course, about direct insight into this phenomena, not just understanding it intellectually, but having a full insight into what is going on. And it's because of that lack of insight that we are trapped in samsara, right? We are like a knotted ball of thread. We're all tangled up, right? We all don't know what we're doing. Attached to this, attached to that. There's all kind of problems in life, all kind of thing. Like a knotted ball of thread, like matted rushes and reeds. All these reeds and rushes, you know, tangled up in each other, and kind of everything is very complicated and difficult. And we keep on going around and around as a consequence. And sometimes you also end up in the lower realms because of this. So this is what the Buddha says. This is kind of his introduction to dependent origination. And he gives this very profound discourse on dependent origination. And this is just a small extract of this discourse, which focuses on nama-rupa, on name and form, here translated as mentality, materiality, which is a bit of a mouthful, and that's probably why he chose name and form instead. Anyway, this is the translation by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, and this is what he has to say here. It was said, with consciousness as condition, there is mentality, materiality here. And how that is so, Ananda, should be understood in this way. If consciousness were not to descend into the mother's womb, would mentality, materiality take shape in the womb? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Right? So the very fact, if a fetus is to develop, right, and eventually be born, consciousness is one of the conditions that is required during that development. Exactly at what point consciousness is required is very hard to say. This doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be there from the very beginning, but at some stage it has to be there for the development to happen properly. These things go together, right? It shows us that the development of the mental and physical aspects of a person always depends on consciousness. The two have to go together here. If after descending into the womb, consciousness were to depart, would mentality, materiality be generated into the present state of being? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. In other words, would that child get born, right? Would it get born if there was no consciousness there? And not really. Or, you get this, get a stillbirth and this kind of thing where the consciousness, the mind has departed and the child is dead upon birth. Again, it is necessary. All the way through the process of life, consciousness is a necessary factor. If the consciousness of a young boy or girl were to be cut off, would mentality, materiality grow up and develop and reach maturity? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, the source, the origin, and the condition for mentality, materiality, namely consciousness. So I think that is probably fairly clear what is going on there. It is not very, it's fairly obvious what's happening here. So we'll just leave it at that, I think. But then, as I said, it's also the reverse. It's not just a consciousness that is a condition for mentality, materiality. Mentality, materiality, nama-rupa, name and form, is a condition for consciousness as well. It was said, with mentality, materiality as condition, there is consciousness. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood in this way. If consciousness were not to gain a footing in mentality, materiality, would an origination of the mass of suffering, of future birth, old age, and death be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, the source, the origin, the condition for consciousness, namely mentality, materiality. So, In other words, consciousness depends on all these other factors for its own existence. Consciousness cannot exist on its own. It's not a separate entity that can just kind of keep on going all on its own. It has to be together with the other aspects of mind and body, the physical and the mental aspects. And this is one of those things which is very Buddhist and very different from all other teachings, all other religions, all other philosophies. Because very often in other philosophies you will hear that, you know, you separate the mind, you separate the consciousness from the other mental and material phenomena, and then consciousness kind of exists on its own, like the ground of all being or whatever they call it. This is part of the idea of the ancient Brahmanical religion, right? Or even today in the more Hindu tradition, the idea that mind can somehow, consciousness can somehow exist separately and can, you know, obtain union with Brahma and all of these kind of things. And this is where Buddhism is very, very different. It says that consciousness cannot exist in this way. If consciousness is released from name and form, then consciousness itself will come to an end. It cannot exist apart from these things. It's a radically different way of looking at the world and looking at nature. The way that this works, I tried to explain this in a little bit yesterday, but now is probably a good time to just to repeat that. And the way this works is that, as I was just saying before, you color your consciousness depends on all the activities you do. You either lift it up or you drag it down, depending on how you live your life. When consciousness, because of all these activities, the consciousness is pointing in a certain direction, right? If you are a sensual person, you enjoy sensual pleasures, the consciousness is pointing towards sensuality. You're always expecting, desiring sensual pleasures. Your intention, your aim is always sensual pleasures. And because your aim is sensual pleasures, it's as if you're pointing, you're heading in that direction. So when you die, you continue, you move on according to that aim, according to that purpose, into a realm of more sensuality. If you've done a lot of bad deeds, those sensual pleasures will not be very refined. If you've done a lot of good deeds, those sensual pleasures will be very refined and very delightful. Or to a certain extent, they will be delightful. But if you get into meditation practice, then instead of aiming for sensual pleasures, you start aiming for deep states of samadhi instead. And then when you die, your mind will be pointing towards samadhi, because that is what you're interested in, right? It will be aiming for that. And then when you die, you move on into that kind of existence. But imagine if when you die, you're not interested in anything anymore, right? Consciousness isn't aiming for anything anymore. It's not planning. Like yesterday, we were talking about intending, planning, and underlying tendencies. But when you die, because you have seen that actually you don't want to exist anymore, it's much more happy not to exist, right? The real happiness is found in not existing. It sounds mad. People think you're nuts. Think the Buddhist teaching is really strange when they hear this sort of thing. But the real happiness is found in not existing. It means that when you die, your consciousness is not pointing towards anything. It's not aiming at anything. It doesn't want to go anywhere. And because it doesn't go anywhere, then when you die, it doesn't actually re-arise in accordance with any aim. It doesn't unify with any mentality, materiality in any particular realm. It basically comes to there, it doesn't go any further. And because it doesn't take up any name and form in a new realm, right, what happens to consciousness? Well, according to most religions, then they will say, oh, then consciousness is free, right? It's liberated, and it will exist by itself forever after, and you are just there, conscious, and everything is fine. But the Buddhist teaching says, no, that's not what happens. If the consciousness isn't aiming at anything, if consciousness isn't established in anything, if it isn't going anywhere, it stops. It ceases. And it comes to an end right there. And that is kind of the amazing thing which makes the Buddhist teaching so different from everything else. And the consequence of that is that both the idea of eternalism and also the idea of annihilationism, they're both wrong. Because annihilationism is wrong, we'll see this in a second, because generally speaking, you continue on when you when you dive according to the station of your consciousness. But if you make an end of all the aiming, all the desiring, all the wanting to exist, then it actually comes to an end. And for that reason, eternalism is wrong. And there is the middle way, and that is called dependent arising, dependent origination itself. So I told you that today was going to be some fairly perhaps new concepts for you, so I'm sure not every one of you have a full clarity about these things. It takes a bit of reflection to understand what is going on here. But I will be going through this in detail a little bit more, because there's another couple of suttas which talk about this particular point. But before I do that, let me just finish off this sutta here. It is to this extent, Ananda, that one can be born, age and die, pass away and re-arise. To this extent that there is a pathway for designation. To this extent that there is a pathway for language. To this extent that there is a pathway for description. To this extent that there is a sphere for wisdom. To this extent that the round turns for describing this state of being. That is, when there is mentality, materiality, together with consciousness. So this, I'm not sure, maybe I should have left that paragraph out, because I'm not sure how relevant it is, and it is a bit cryptic, right? When you read this, you wonder, what is going on here? This is really strange. And you really have to... It isn't very obvious what is going on at all, but actually the ideas which underlie this are not all that complicated. It may look complicated when you see it, but actually it isn't as complicated as you think. And the first thing he says here is that it is to this extent that one is born, one becomes old, that one dies, that one passes away and re-arises, right? And this goes together with the line which is further down, which says, it is to this extent that the round turns for describing this state of being. And all what this means is that as far as... this is all just a description of samsara, right? Samsara is about being born, about going old and dying, and then re-arising again in a new situation, on and on and on like that. That is what is meant by the round turns. You're going round and round and round from life to life, coming back to the beginning again. That's really all it means. So it is just a description of the process of samsara, of being born and passing away. And so what the Buddha is saying here is that it is only this consciousness and name and form, consciousness and mentality, materiality, vijnana and namarupa, this is really all there ever is, right? There is nothing apart from this. And whenever you get born, whenever you go anywhere, this is all you experience, name and form and consciousness, in different qualities, right? Sometimes you have like Chinese food, then you have Sri Lankan food, then you have some kind of French cuisine, right? These are different types of name and form, different types of experience, right? Sometimes we do all these different ways of experiencing the world, different types of lives, and that's really all it is. So one way, what is interesting about this particular sutta as well, is that it stops at that point. It goes back to name and form being the conditions for consciousness, and it doesn't go back to sankhara and ignorance. We have been starting off with ignorance, right, avidya, and that's a condition for sankhara, that becomes a condition for vijnana. But this sutta instead, it goes back to vijnana and says the condition for consciousness is name and form. So it's a different kind of, it shows this in a different way. And the reason is because name and form itself just continues back into the past with no apparent first cause, right? You can say that every life into the past is just consciousness and name and form conditioning each other back and back and back in time, sometimes re-arising in a certain birth and a different type of life and a different type of existence. That is all that goes on into the past. So this is just an alternative way of looking at this idea of dependent arising here. One way is to look to sankharas, another way is just to see this mutual conditionality going back virtually forever as far as you can see back into the past. So this is what it means, right? As far as samsara goes, this is all there is. This is the sum total of experience. In the end, life is just experience. That's all it is. Different types of experience, depending on where you go. And this is what that experience is all about. And then it says, and this is, we can maybe look at this very briefly. It says that it is to this extent that there is a pathway for designation, a pathway for language, a pathway for description. So this just means that whenever we talk about the world, whenever we talk about anything, we are always talking about the consciousness together with name and form. These are the five khandhas, basically. That's all we can ever talk about. Whenever we describe anything or talk about anything, it's always about those things. Because, and again, the reason for that is because the five khandhas, they are the sum total of experience. This is all we can ever experience. And we talk about things, we talk about that. But what is what is underlying here, the underlying thing that this is trying to point to, perhaps, is that the way we talk about the world, the way we describe the world, the way we understand experience, the way we understand the khandhas, is almost always in terms of the self, right? We understand this in terms of I exist, right? I exist in a certain way. There's a sense of permanence inside of us, a sense of this self I have, hooray, the self is here, it's a good self, I'm happy, and all of these kind of things. And so this, the way that we look at these five khandhas, the way we talk about them, is usually a distorted way. We don't see them as they actually are. This is what the Buddha is saying. You have all these descriptions of these things, but the descriptions are often false. So one of the purposes that we are trying to achieve in the Buddhist practice is to see the experienced reality, to see the experienced world in the right way, to see it for what it is, empty of the self, and just all these conditioned phenomena rolling on from life to life, from existence to existence. And that is why the next line or the next phrase says, it is to this extent that there is a sphere for wisdom. If you start to investigate your experience, if you start to investigate the five khandhas, the five aspects of personality, eventually, if your meditation is deep enough, you will see that your previous understanding of these things was wrong. It was distorted. There was a degree of delusion there in regard to these things. So by investigating, it's actually possible to find out what is happening here. So what all of this is saying is that everything really is about this consciousness and mental and material phenomena. There is nothing apart from that. This is all there is. This is all that experience is. This is where wisdom arises. This is where delusion arises. This is where samsara arises. Everything is about this. This is what this is really saying here. Okay, so anyway, if you want to read about these things, there is a book by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi where he describes and discusses this sutta in great detail. The book is called The Great Discourse on Causation, and it talks about these things, and you can read it. But please remember that Bhikkhu Bodhi he's a philosopher, and sometimes the way he talks can also kind of boggle the mind a little bit. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you will become any wiser by reading what he has to say here. But anyway, the book is there if you're interested here. Okay, so now let us move on to the next sutta. This is called the Kacchanagata Sutta, and it is basically talking about exactly what we have been talking about now, but from a slightly different viewpoint. And this sutta is often looked upon as one of the most profound suttas, perhaps. All the suttas are profound, but this is often kind of pulled out to be especially profound because it deals with exactly the things that we've been talking about now. So anyway, let's see what it has to say, and then let's discuss it as we go through it. At Savati, then the Venerable Kacchanagata approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, in what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view?" Right? So this is interesting, of course, from the point of dependent arising, because right view is very similar to the idea that at the very beginning we are deluded, we are misunderstanding things. Avidya is part of the problem. So right view, maybe we can rectify the very beginning of dependent arising by understanding what right view is, right? So this ties into dependent arising very nicely right there. And then the Buddha gives this reply about what right view is. And it's not the ordinary reply, right? This is a different type of reply. That's what kind of makes it interesting here. This world, the Kacchana, for the most part, depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for the one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. Right? Okay, so let's break this up a little bit and see if we can get to grips with this. So, first of all, the Buddha says here that the world depends upon a duality. And the duality here are these two different notions, these two different views, these two different ways of looking at the world. Right? One is called existence, and the other one is called non-existence. And of course, the notion of existence is precisely the feeling that when you die, you will just go on forever. There is an inherent aspect in you which is always there, which will carry on. The soul, if you like, or the self, or whatever you call it, that's inside of you, that will keep on going forever and ever. This is the notion of existence. And of course, the notion of non-existence is exactly the opposite. That when you die, everything will come to an end. And that's it. There's no inherent existing entity inside of you. Existence and non-existence, right? We're kind of familiar with these terms, these ideas by now. And it says, the world depends upon these things, right? So what that means is that these are kind of viewpoints. These are ways of relating to the world. And it just shows that we have a tendency to cling to these kind of views, to attach to these kind of views, to depend on these kind of views. If somebody challenges you on something that is very dearly held by you as a view, whatever that might be, you might get upset, or you might refuse to listen, or you might get defensive, or whatever, right? If our very deeply held views are challenged, it is often very difficult to deal with it. And that's how you know that you are depending on that view, because you don't really want to hear otherwise. You're not ready to have that challenge, basically. And so here the Buddha is challenging some of the most deeply held views that almost everyone is holding on to. If you are not an Aryan yet, to some extent you're going to have either of these views, the view of non-existence or the view of existence. You can't avoid that, because both of these views are ultimately based on the sense of self, that you just are just part of what it means to be a human being, until you get profound enough insight to see that actually it is just an illusion in the first place. So you depend on these things. We depend on our views, right? Our sense of self itself is dependent on those views. We kind of we measure ourselves on our views and on what we believe in to a very large extent. And because of that, we cannot just give up the views just like that. It takes time and it takes practice to do that. So we depend on this. The world depends on this duality, right? But there are some people who don't depend on that duality. And this is what is coming up next. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. Right? So, first of all, again, what is the world here? And this is what I have been saying just before. Remember, the world, from a Buddhist point of view, means the world of experience, right? How we experience things, all the things that we see and hear. One way of looking at it is to think about it as the six senses, right? Seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, and then the mind as the sixth sense. So So those six senses, there's nothing apart from those six senses. Everything in existence must somehow be part of those six senses, right? Nothing is outside of that. And for this reason, the world is really the world of experience. Whatever we experience through those six senses. Another way of looking at that is the five khandhas. Just another way of summarizing all of experience. All of experience is about perception, about being conscious of things, about feeling things. It's another way of looking at that. So this is what is meant by the world here, the experiential world. There was a nice sutta called the Rohitasa Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara 4:45, I think it is. And that is where the Buddha says that the world is found in this fathom-long body. It's just another way of saying that our experience is what the world is. And any world apart from that is kind of irrelevant from a Buddhist point of view. So this is the world, right? So for one who sees the origin of the world with correct wisdom. So first of all, correct wisdom here means the wisdom of the stream enter. Someone who has seen reality for what it actually is. At this point is when you become a noble person, an Arya, you have had full insight into the teachings of the Buddha. Right? So this is the full insight into these teachings. And what does that person see? He sees the origin of the world. In other words, you see the origin of experience. And this is what I was just talking about before. This doesn't mean seeing the Big Bang, right? The origin of the world. This is the origin of experience. It is just this idea that when you die, because consciousness is aiming for something else, consciousness is attached to certain things. Consciousness is holding on to experience in a certain way. That aiming of consciousness will mean that it will establish itself in a new existence also. There will be another life coming after this. There will be a continuation of existence, right? And this is what you see when you become an Arya. You see how this process must carry on, how this aiming of consciousness, this projection of yourself into the future, means that when life comes to an end, consciousness does not come to an end. You get reborn, you carry on into the future. You have seen the origin of the world. Origin of the world meaning the origin of experience itself. Right? And because you have seen the origin of the world in this way, you know that the idea of non-existence is wrong. It doesn't just become annihilated when you die. It just doesn't work like that. The way it works is that you continue on as a consequence. So you see that the view of annihilation is a mistaken view. Right? And then there is the that is one side of the equation. Then you have the other side of the equation. That is for the one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom. There is no notion of existence in regard to the world. And this is, again, as I was explaining just a minute ago, the idea when, if consciousness isn't aiming for anything, if consciousness isn't interested in any particular type of existence, if it isn't standing on anything, there's no underlying tendencies towards anything, then when you come to death, when you're about to pass away, consciousness has nowhere to go. It isn't aiming for anything. It doesn't head towards any particular realm, any particular experience. And because of that, consciousness is not established in any name and form. And because it isn't established in any name and form, if you're an arahant, if you're fully awakened, consciousness comes to an end right there. Right? So this is what it means, that you see the cessation of the world. Seeing the cessation of the world means you understand that when consciousness isn't aiming for anything in the future, it just comes to an end right here. So this is what it means, that the world ceases. And because the world can cease, it means that the idea of existence, the idea of an inherent self that keeps carrying on, that too must be a mistake, right? So now you can see, you can start to understand why the Buddhist teaching is this middle way between existence and annihilation. It is a conditioned process that keeps on going as long as the conditions are in place. Remove the conditions for the process to keep going, and the process comes to a halt. It stops by itself. So this is why dependent origination is the middle way between existence and annihilation. This is very profound, right? And it's really impossible to fully understand this until you have this kind of experience and you see this for yourself. You become a stream enterer and you see this with the mind's eye. The eye of the Dhamma arises and you understand what's going on. It's a very kind of a sophisticated way of looking at the world, very different from any other teaching you find anywhere, any other philosophy or psychology or religion or spirituality or whatever. The Buddhist way is quite unique in this sense. And then the Buddha goes on. So he had kind of now laid down what it means to see things according to reality. And then he continues on and he says, this world, Kacchana, is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging, and adherence. But this one, with right view, does not become engaged and cling. Through that engagement and clinging, the mental standpoint, adherence, underlying tendency, he does not take a stand about myself. He has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising. What ceases is only suffering ceasing. Let's just stop there. So the world is for the most part shackled by engagement and clinging. This is all about attachment, right? We are holding on to things, holding on to, especially here, these views about permanence, about things lasting, eternalism, annihilationism, etc. We are holding on to these things. And in a way, once you have those views and you hold on to those views, it means that they also shackle you. They tie you to samsara. So you're actually bound by these views. And because you're bound by these views, you carry on from life to life as a consequence. This is part of the problem of having these views, that they actually drive the process of samsara itself. Because you are deluded. As long as you have those views, you will go out and seek for happiness in the world. And when you seek for happiness, you will do all of these things, these activities, which then leads to rebirth, etc. We were looking about the other day. It's only when you abandon those views and you see that there is nothing really inherent worth holding on to here, that that process of creative process actually comes to a halt. So the person who is a stream enterer, right viewer, he doesn't have all that engagement and clinging anymore. He doesn't hold on to all these views about myself, right? He does not take a stand about myself, he says here. Or you can say he doesn't focus on, or is not interested in the idea, I have a self. That has kind of disappeared from him. Attame is a Pali. Attame can be translated in different ways. Myself or I have a self are both legitimate ways of translating that. So he doesn't have a foundation. He doesn't base his life on this idea. He doesn't hold on to it. And he doesn't focus on it. It's no longer, he has lost that sense of I have a self, right? And this is basically what this means. He doesn't cling and hold on to these things. And because of that, it says here, he has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising, and what ceases is only suffering ceasing. And this is kind of the view of the Arahant, and you see this in the few places in the suttas. This idea that when you, existence is just that, existence is suffering coming into existence, suffering passing away. And in the final analysis, suffering passing away actually means precisely the parinibbana of the Arahat. When the Arahat, the fully awakened person, dies, that is kind of the final cessation of suffering. The suffering arises. Every time we get reborn, it's like suffering arising. And the final cessation of suffering really, really only happens when you pass away as an Arahat. That is all there is, right? And this is why sometimes you get the question arising: what happens when the Arahat dies? When the Arahant dies, what happens then? You know, are you there to experience it, or you know, what's the point of being happy if you can't experience the happiness? And these kind of questions. But remember that the whole point here, from a Buddhist point of view, is to make an end of suffering, right? This is the whole purpose of this path. And there is a sutta where somebody asks Venerable Sariputta this particular question. What happens when all of these things cease? What happens after that? And the very interesting reply that Venerable Sariputta gives to this person, he says that, well, that's just papancha. It's just proliferation. Why are you asking that question in the first place? And it's a very interesting answer, because what it means is that the reason why we are interested in what happens after the arahant dies, the reason why that is important to us is because we have the sense of self in the first place. It is the sense of self that makes it important to us whether there is something there afterwards or not. But for the arahant, it's irrelevant. You know, the sense of self has been seen through. Whether there is something or not afterwards kind of misses the point. The point is that when the arahant passes away, suffering passes away. Suffering comes to an end, right? Wow, this is it. This is the purpose of the whole life. I have succeeded in achieving the highest happiness when all suffering passes away. Everything else is irrelevant. The question of whether there's something or not, that's just proliferation, because it comes from the idea of the self in the first place. And you have seen through that. You know that these things are irrelevant. Life is just a sequence of suffering arising and suffering passing away. So, this is very profound, right, to say the least. And for that reason, this is why, one of the reasons why dependent origination is considered such a profound teaching, because it includes, involves all of these profound points of view. And he has no perplexity or doubt about this, precisely because he has seen this, or she has seen this with her own eyes. His knowledge about this is independent of others. It is in this way, Kachana, that there is right view. It is independent of others because you have seen it for yourself. And this is why, once you become a stream enter, you become like a rock in the world. You become like a solid pillar. You become like something which is where you can take a stand, and you don't really worry anymore about what other people think, because you have seen reality for yourself. This is kind of one of the ways of knowing whether somebody is a stream mentor. They have this incredible sense of independence about them. And they can take a stand on things without worrying about what other people say. So, there is right view. All exists, Kachana. This is one extreme. All does not exist. This is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata, the Buddha, teaches the Dhamma by the middle. All exist is one extreme. It is a little bit difficult to know how to understand all exists. One way of understanding this is to understand that at the time of the Buddha, the Brahmanical religion, the religions which are kind of the precursors to modern-day Hinduism, these had this idea that the self and the world is the same thing, right? The self is the world is the self. And exactly what they meant by that, I'm not sure. I'm not an expert in the Brahmanical teachings. But there's something about Brahma really being the world, and you have union with Brahma, so you and the world are the same. And perhaps the other aspects of the world are delusive, or something like that. But it doesn't really matter what it means. The point here is just that this was a view that was prevalent at the time. And he's just saying that this is one extreme, and it's the wrong one. Nothing exists. It's this idea that everything just comes to an end when you pass away. These are the two extremes. And again, dependent arising is in the middle. But there is another interesting aspect to this in this particular sutta. And I'll just mention that in passing, just for interest, for those of you who might be interested in this. And there is a philosophical issue here as well, because the idea all exist. This is sabbang ati in Pali. And this is the view that was held by a certain school of Buddhism in ancient India. This was called the Sarvastivadin school. Sarvastivada in Pali is sabbativada. Sabbang ati, sabbativada is the same word, right? And this was a school of Buddhism that said everything exists. That's why they're called Sarvastivada. Sarva, all, asti, exists, vada, doctrine, the doctrine that all exists. And this was what this school had. So some people have seen this particular phrase that is here, which isn't really necessary for the sutta to function. The sutta works very well without that phrase. Some have seen that as a kind of an addition that was added later on to counteract the Sarvastivadin idea of all exists. Because from the Theravadin point of view, that was a very bad view, to have the view that all exists, right? This is one of those things in ancient India, they had all these debates. And there's a very well-known book in the Pali Canon called the Katavatu, the basis for discussion, the basis for talk. And this book is just a whole book which refutes the views of other schools. That's what it does. Part of the Abhidhamma Pitaka. And this is one of the schools that is debated against. It's the idea that all exists. This was the idea that the Sarvastivadin had. And you may think it's a strange view to have, right? For a Buddhist school, all exists. What do they mean by that? And of course, it's quite a sophisticated view. It's quite, they have a lot of philosophy around that. But nevertheless, it was considered very, very wrong from the Theravadin point of view. So that is just for your interest. That is also kind of underlying here, is underlying the this idea, is this kind of discussion that may have existed with the Sarvastivadin school at the time. Anyway, that's just don't worry too much about that, because it's really a bit beside the point. But anyway, there it is. And then the Buddha teaches the Dhamma by the middle, right? This is another way of understanding the Buddhist middle way. The middle way is not just the middle way between the extremes of sensual pleasure and torturing yourself. It's also the middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. And that is what dependent arising is. It is that middle way here. With ignorance as condition, with avidya as condition, with delusion as condition, there are these willed activities, and with the willed activities there is consciousness, and with consciousness as condition there is name and form, as we have just seen. And then we're going to go into all the other factors of dependent arising over the next couple of days or so. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. But when this all fades away, and with the cessation of consciousness, such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So there you are. This is the Katshanagotta Sutta, and sometimes considered one of the most profound suttas in the canon. And you can sort of see why, right? It's or at least one of those that have a very interesting message in a sense. And you can see why that is the case. So again, don't worry too much if you don't understand these things. Sometimes it is fun or enjoyable to bring in a few new things on these retreats. And this is what I've been doing here, because I think dependent origination is a very important issue to be dealt with. And it's not so much that you have to understand everything, but just something to consider on this path. The point of this, it is a little bit philosophical perhaps, and may not have any direct, immediate, practical bearings on how you live your life, but it is at the core of the Buddhist outlook. This is the very essence of the Buddhist outlook, how the Buddhist teachings look at the world. And for that reason, I think it is interesting. And for that reason, it also points your mind, in a sense, in the right direction. Whether you agree or not, if you don't agree, that's fine. And if you think this is interesting, then that is, of course, even better. So that is what this sutta is all about. Okay, so that is, the hour has already passed. So we'll stop there, and we'll see you again this afternoon at 3:00.